The situation is extremely grim. I mean, of course, there aren't any words that can explain the situation. It's extremely, extremely grim.
India in dire need of COVID vaccine. It's Wednesday, May 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, rights groups slam Australia's India response. Navigating the Afghanistan withdrawal. COVID adds challenges for female journalists. A museum reopens. Finding joy amidst the pandemic. It's all on today's VOA Asia. India has opened its immunization drive to all adults as it reels under a catastrophic second wave of the novel coronavirus pandemic. But a shortage of vaccines in the country, often called a vaccine powerhouse, means inoculating a significant part of the 1.4 billion population is still a distant goal. Anjana Pasricha has a report.
This is the most coveted jab in India as it reels under a ferocious second wave of the novel coronavirus pandemic. But although the inoculation drive for COVID-19 has been expanded to all above 18 years of age, vaccine shortages are hobbling the program.
The situation is extremely grim. I mean, of course, there aren't any words that can explain the situation. It's extremely, extremely grim. The system is at a brink of collapse. And that's the reason why we tried to get vaccinated as early as possible.
But some states say they cannot cover the 18-plus age group. They are even turning away older people as vaccine stockpiles fall short of demand. India, the world's largest vaccine producer, was relying on domestically produced doses. But the approximately 70 million shots being produced a month cannot cater to its massive needs.
And if you take the 18 to 44 age group, who are the new entrants into the program, we are talking about 595 million people. So we are talking about 1.2 billion doses, right? Because everybody requires two doses of the vaccine. So in a sense, it's a huge ask. And our vaccine stocks currently do not measure up anywhere near that.
The government has stepped up efforts to get vaccines from overseas. Sputnik V doses arrived from Russia this week. Efforts are also on to accelerate domestic manufacturing. But it could take months to plug the shortfalls. Experts say India failed to stockpile enough vaccines as it prematurely declared victory against the pandemic during a lull in infections. It sent about 65 million doses to other countries as part of a vaccine diplomacy push.
I think it was sort of factored in their minds that we will not have to deal with the second wave, and therefore we could have fairly measured, steady, graduated vaccination program which can flow in steps. And that is why we even felt we had the luxury of sending vaccines abroad to about 80 countries.
The sluggish rollout meant the country was largely unprotected when the second wave struck. About 2% of the population has been fully inoculated, while around 10% have received one dose. Now, fear overhangs the worst-hit cities like New Delhi, where hospitals and crematoriums are overwhelmed.
I deleted the social media apps for about a week in the middle because I just couldn't take it. You know, every time you open Twitter and everything, it's full of that. But then I had to get back because I realized that a lot of people are, you know, seeking help on that platform. And if I could be of any help, then I need to be available. So it's very anxious. I mean, the times are very anxious.
That anxiety will remain in a country waging an ongoing battle for hospital beds, drugs and oxygen. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. India on brink as second COVID wave devastates major cities. Afghans fear Taliban return to power after withdrawal of U.S. forces. Largely spared since 2020, Taiwan now grapples with small COVID cluster. South Korea dairy company CEO resigns over virus research scandal. In China, writing about pandemic, cultural heritage can get you arrested. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and so much more when you visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia and our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Rights groups and opposition politicians criticize Australia's new ban on citizens returning from coronavirus-hit India. From Monday, Australia began implementing a law that could land its citizens and permanent residents up to 5 years in jail and a fine of up to $50,000 if they try to enter Australia from India. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The government has said the ban aims to protect Australia's hotel quarantine system for returned travellers. Officials have said more than half of recent COVID-19 infections detected in isolation hotels were linked to travellers arriving from India. Senior ministers say the law isn't racist and that this is a public health issue, while some immigrants in the country say it unfairly targets permanent residents and citizens who happen to be immigrants from India. Siddhi Gupta from Melbourne is one of thousands of Australians stranded in India. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that she feels abandoned and expressed the anguish she's experiencing due to separation from her children.
My mind is completely stuck in thinking, how will I be able to go back? Whenever I talk to my children, it's so disheartening to hear from them. When are you coming back, Mama?
Critics say the latest legal measures go a bit too far, citing parallel measures taken during earlier coronavirus surges in other countries. They say people travelling from Europe or the United States weren't met with similar measures. The new ban and punishment, some experts say, is illegal and breaches laws enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 13 in the Declaration states that individuals have the right to leave and return to their own country. Health Minister Greg Hunt said the ban announced on Saturday would be reconsidered on May 15. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison again defended the restrictions.
This is a way to ensure that we can prevent the virus coming back and starting a third wave here in Australia that would have devastating impacts on our country. We're going to keep bringing back people safely from India, but we have to do it in a way that won't subject the rest of the country to seeing a third wave of COVID. It's a temporary measure.
A poll released Monday by the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research body, has shown broad support for Australia's hardline approach to containing the spread of the virus. Foreign nationals were banned from Australia in March 2020. Australian citizens and permanent residents, apart from those who've been in India, are allowed to come back home from elsewhere in the world. They then remain in mandatory hotel quarantine for 14 days, or for about 2 weeks after entry, but there are quotas in place, and an estimated 36,000 Australians are stranded overseas, including about 9,000 in India, according to government figures. Australians wanting to go abroad need government permission, although there has been unrestricted travel with New Zealand since April 18. Australia has recorded just under 30,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began. 910 people have died, according to the health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, India's Minister of External Affairs has expressed appreciation for the help India is getting from the United States in dealing with COVID-19. His thanks came during a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is off to a great start. We're glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. As the United States and its allies officially begin withdrawing forces from Afghanistan, fears of increased violence and a Taliban return to power are making many Afghans anxious. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more from the capital, Kabul.
Today is just another day for Noor Ahmad in Kabul. He deep fries samosas, a local favorite, hoping to sell them for iftar, the breaking of fast during Ramadan. He does not care whether the foreign forces stay or go.
The withdrawal will not impact our daily lives. No Americans or foreigners buy my food. Only Afghans buy it. So far, everything is going on as usual.
The United States and its allies have officially started withdrawing forces from Afghanistan and handing over operations to their Afghan counterparts. Some, like Ahmed, are indifferent, but the move to withdraw forces has sent shockwaves through large segments of society.
Right now, all Afghan women are concerned, really concerned. We wish the international community would do something about protecting us. We fear things will go back to the past.
The past is when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan and women had few rights. Since then, the country has made huge strides. The new Afghanistan is marked with an explosion of media and entertainment options and an abundance of college-educated young people and working women. The international community has promised to stay engaged with the country after foreign forces are out. But Taliban have increased their attacks on the government and Afghan security forces in the past year. And peace negotiations between Taliban and the Afghan government have stalled. Confidence in the Afghan security forces and their ability to hold back the Taliban is low. Many, including senior U.S. officials, fear fighting will intensify and make cities vulnerable to a Taliban takeover. The government is trying to ease concerns. Last week, it gave media outlets a tour of the Special Operations Forces base, complete with guns blazing and tanks firing.
We expect the same thing, fighting, the intense fighting, but we are ready for that. It's our country. We will fight till the end, and we will eliminate his terrorists from Afghanistan.
Tough words that many, particularly young people, say provide little comfort. Many say even a negotiated political settlement with the Taliban will likely lead to a rollback of rights gained over two decades. In the worst case, they fear a return to the 1990s, when a bloody, multi-year civil war led to a Taliban military takeover of Kabul. As people go about their daily lives, walking around the streets, shopping for Eid, the apparent normalcy hides the nervousness of a nation anxious about its future. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
Aisha Tanzim has been very busy in Kabul. She recently sat down with Abdullah Abdullah, the chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, for his thoughts on the U.S. withdrawal and Taliban negotiations.
We think more on the military term rather than peaceful means. And that's the concern, that Taliban position might get further emboldened. Well, as far as their excuses or the reasons that they were giving, that it's because of the presence of the international forces, it's jihad against the foreigners and so on and so forth. So in 3 months' time, perhaps even less than 3 months' time, there will be no foreign troops in our soil.
Join VOA Asia tomorrow for much more of Aisha Tanzim's conversation with Abdullah Abdullah, the chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Taiwan is grappling with a small, though spreadable, COVID outbreak that began with cargo pilots coming into the main international airport. This spread could threaten the Taiwanese government's reputation as a quick, effective handler of the disease. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We have more VOA Asia. The coronavirus pandemic has killed more than 3.1 million people, and it has infected more than 147 million worldwide, according to Johns Hopkins University. Living through and documenting the pandemic brought a multitude of challenges, especially for women reporters, according to the Coalition for Women in Journalism. We hear more from VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo.
The lockdown that began in March 2020 were key strategies used around the world to slow the spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
As you know, journalists have to be on the front line and they have to be out there to be able to report. I think in the early March, we saw this complete sort of huge challenge where women journalists, especially freelancers, were facing this challenge of finding a job to be able to do.
As the pandemic took a toll on lives, governments took drastic measures, including closing borders and imposing quarantines to protect medical systems from being strained. But some of them also tried to control the storyline, she says.
We saw this in Turkey, Lebanon, Egypt, some of these countries, China, Pakistan, some of these countries use the opportunity of COVID-19 into politicizing the issue and creating misinformation about journalists who had been trying to do their job.
How so? She explains.
This has happened in Pakistan. I'll give you an example of one of our members, Asma Shirazi. Whenever she is reporting on, you know, the spread of the virus, government inefficiencies, or whatever, you know, whatever the government should be doing and they aren't doing, she's targeted with misinformation campaigns. We have several other similar incidents where women journalists have been impeded after reporting on COVID-19 in particular.
In Turkey, journalist Ebru Kucukaydin was taken into custody after one of her coronavirus reports and later released. The Turkish government accused her of creating panic. Other journalists, Malaysia's award-winning Wan Noor Hayati and The Guardian's Cairo correspondent Ruth Michelson, faced charges or were expelled or harassed for their coverage of the pandemic, the coalition says. Last year, the International Federation of Journalists surveyed nearly 560 female reporters from 52 countries and found that stress increased for 77% since the pandemic began. Catherine Gicheru leads the Africa Women Journalism Project in Kenya, an initiative started by the International Center for Journalists. She's seen the negative effects the pandemic has had on some women journalists in countries where gender discrimination is widespread.
This, I have reports also from the fellows in Tanzania and in Uganda, as well as in Nigeria, is the fact that if you have to work from home, then you're the one who's also taking care of the family. And that's 2, 3, 4 times the job that she was, a woman journalist was previously doing. And that is across the board. So you have a mental anxiety, the stresses, the fears that everybody has, but much more for women, especially women journalists.
She also says women journalists have been hit with job losses.
It's a problem all over the world, but a lot of journalists have lost their jobs. The women, a lot of them, especially in Kenya, are either on contract terms or are freelancers. And the fact that they've lost this, they've either been laid off or they've been put on half pay, it means the situation has become even more difficult.
And she says it has had an impact on coverage of other women-related topics, including sexual health, obstetric fistula, and female genital mutilation. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, the Indian Premier League, cricket's richest competition, was suspended indefinitely Tuesday after players or staff at three teams tested positive for the coronavirus amid a surge in nationwide infections. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the ornate National Building Museum in Washington, D.C. has reopened its doors after more than a year. Maxim Moskalkov reports the museum launched two new exhibitions to mark the occasion.
After being closed for 16 months due to renovations and the COVID-19 pandemic, The National Building Museum has reopened with a new look and some new exhibitions.
We have been open for 1 weekend only so far. We are limiting our hours and our days. We're only open Friday, Saturday, Sunday from 11 to 4. And it was crowded in here this weekend.
To celebrate its opening, the museum has launched 2 new exhibitions. One of them is dedicated to Mass Design Group, an organization that creates projects to help fight diseases like TB, cholera, and Ebola.
They found that by sort of creating as much outdoor space as possible in their design of these healthcare centers, they really help reduce the risk of disease transmission. Also, it's part of their design is allowing lots of good airflow and lots of ventilation and opportunities for sunlight and views and accessibility to nature.
The second exhibition is a memorial project honoring victims of gun violence in the U.S. It also was created by Mass Design in collaboration with artist Hank Willis Thomas and the Every Town for Gun Safety Fund, the largest nonprofit campaigning against gun violence in America.
58% of the American population has been directly impacted, or someone they love has been impacted by gun violence. So it's a lot of people. And we, for years, had been interested in the concept of a memorial because it is obviously it's a way to commemorate these lives that have been taken.
The memorial consists of 4 houses, each made of 700 glass blocks to honor the lives of those who died from gun violence.
The glass house, which is, you know, the United States, where we are often pointing fingers and maybe throwing rocks at the problems of other countries, but not really aware of the vulnerability of our own society.
In 2020, gun violence killed nearly 20,000 Americans, according to data from Gun Violence Archive. An additional 24,000 people died by suicide with a gun. The exhibition will be open until September 25, 2022, and is free for visitors. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
While the pandemic has been a source of grief, it has not stopped joyful events from happening, including thousands of babies being born in this difficult time. Photographer Ann Geddes, creator of the Joy Project, is encouraging women from around the world to send her pictures of their newborns for publication and a pick-me-up. Anna Nelson has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
What if you could look at a map and know where the next COVID-19 outbreak would be and how soon it would happen? One exists, fueled by machine learning.
So in order to respond to the pandemic at the local level, it's important to understand how the disease spreads at what rate in a given county or in a given city.
Available to the public, this online map is not a present snapshot of how much disease there is in a community. It's a summary of how fast the virus is spreading. The darker the colors on the map, the more likely an outbreak will happen. This type of prediction is possible with the help of data entered into an algorithm. The data include reported COVID-19 cases and deaths, geographic location, employment rate, face mask mandates, daily number of tests, and other information.
As in any prediction modeling, the quality is as good as the input data is.
Analyzing the data for each county would take days or weeks for humans to make a prediction. But machine learning speeds up and automates the process of detecting an outbreak. Researchers say even with vaccines, something like this COVID-19 outbreak detection tool is still valuable.
If new strains come, the new variants, and the vaccine is not working on them, or they at some point, the duration of protection from vaccines will wane. We don't know that yet, when it's going to happen, but at some point it may happen. It may happen 12 months from now or 18 months from now.
Currently, this tool only predicts outbreaks in the U.S. because of the challenge of collecting data in other countries. With enough information, researchers say they are open to creating a detection tool for other countries in the future to help public health officials better plan or even avoid an outbreak. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
That's all the time we have for today's program. Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. We're not finished. Continue with us online, on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. We also thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.